Company of Makers, podcast, talks, workshops.
We are here because for the first time for many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power.
The task force, with all its power, is ready. Britain has gathered its might. It must set its course.
I'm not allowed to say how many planes joined the raid, but I counted them all out, and I counted them all back.
We're now between the two gun lines, and there's a right old artillery duel going on between them.
There is a white flag flying over Stanley. Very marvellous.
Welcome to Land, Sea and Air, Stories from the Armed Forces. In this series, we hear untold stories from the Falklands War, 40 years on. This is the story of the conflict, told by eight different people who were actually there.
Hi, Steve. Another discussion with one of the veterans from the Falklands 40 years ago, and a different perspective, this time from the eyes of someone on HMS Coventry helicopter team. So a different perspective from Chris Howe's chat with you about life on board and what he went through.
Let's give it a listen. Mick, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast.
You're welcome.
So you have a story for me, I believe. We're obviously talking about the Falklands, and
yeah.
I'm going to start with the same question I ask pretty much everybody. Where were you, and did you know where the Falklands was, or is, rather?
We were on exercise in Gibraltar, and we were leaving Gibraltar to go continue the exercise and go for a high seas firing, test out the missile systems. And we were then told that we were not going there and we were diverting to go south to the Falkland Islands. And again, in answer to that well-known question, we all thought, where the hell are they? And to be honest, I didn't know anybody on the ship who knew where the Falkland Islands were. But as good servicemen, we just followed the brief and off we went. And instead of turning right for the UK, we turned left towards the Falkland Islands.
I love this way. So, I love this way of navigating. Turn right and left. I wished it was that simple. What ship were you on, Mick?
I was Fleet Air Arm, so it's either port or starboard or left or right.
What ship were you on, Mick?
HMS Coventry, and we were with many other ships diverted the same way, but we soon found out that we could send a telegram home to say that we weren't coming home as planned, and then we could write letters at a later date. And we also found out that there were a lot more ships coming from the UK that we would be joining up with. And things developed from there, where we were heading south down through the tropics and exercising daily to get ready for an imminent conflict that was going to happen, which none of us believed would ever take place. So off we went.
Off you went. What was your role on board Coventry?
I was on the ship's flight, and I was the electrical and weapons supervisor. So as normal, when we're at sea, the helicopter is tasked to do lots of different things. And we would service the helicopter, maintain it, and get it airborne and recover it when needed. And again, heading off south, we were tasked to do lots of different exercises, but we didn't really know the meaning behind most of them. We could arm the helicopter with torpedoes, depth charges and the like. And we would practice doing that at short notice and practice getting the effects more efficient so that when it was needed, we could do it in the blink of an eye. And that's basically what a lot of our training was all about. So we carried on south, and a lot of the ships around us were doing similar things, and they would interact. And quite often, our helicopter might have to be the captain's taxi, if you like, taking him to another ship where the heads of departments would meet and have their meetings and discussions. And then, of course, the helicopter would bring him back. And at the end of every day, there was set maintenance that we would have to do on the helicopter. So we'd put it in the hangar, continue out our servicing, and then put it to bed. And away we went to our beds or for meals and the like, and a few beverages.
Of course. So what was the mood on board ship at this point as you were heading south?
I'd say fairly relaxed, because, again, none of us believed it was ever going to happen. So we carried on with our normal duties. We had lots of the ship's company around us doing their various tasks. And we had one guy that worked in the ops room, who was the helicopter controller. So whenever the aircraft was in the air, he was in contact with it. And then he would leave the ops room and come back up to the hangar for the debrief after the sortie. And we'd all maybe sit and discuss the day's events over a cup of coffee or whatever. So, the mood was fairly relaxed heading south until we got, I think we got to Ascension Islands. And then it became apparent that there was a lot more ships there than we ever thought. And it became apparent that it was probably going to be a lot more active as we went further south again. And we landed the helicopter ashore to do certain maintenance tasks ashore that you can't do when you're on board a ship, like testing out the compass system, what we call the compass swing, and fuel calibration. You can't do that on a ship when it's bobbing about on the ocean.
Mm.
So we, it wasn't essential maintenance, but they're sort of the long-range tasks that you have to do, and we took the opportunity to land at Ascension and do it. Back on board, we again, I think a lot of stores came out through Ascension as well, so ships were storing up and equipping to their best of their abilities, and then off we went and we headed south yet again. With some of the tasks and the exercises were becoming a little bit different to what we would normally experience. For instance, the larger helicopters, like the Sea Kings and things like that, and Wessex, they couldn't land on our deck. It wasn't large enough, but they could deploy troops. And quite often the exercise would be that the helicopter would hover over our flight deck, and troops, SAS or whatever, would abseil down onto the deck, because it was made aware that the Argentinians had three Type 42 destroyers. So the boarding crews needed to exercise at attacking or boarding them types of ships. Again, we never saw any of their 42s because they never came out of harbour, so it was immaterial anyway. But they were the exercises that needed to be done. And, of course, distributing mail around the ships and things like that. And one of the biggest tasks as well, of course, was equipping the ships. We had all the RFAs, the auxiliaries, with us. And, of course, as the ships use most of their stores, they have to be replenished. So yeah, you can do that at sea, or you can do it with helicopter transfers. And there was a lot of that going on as we went south as well.
So how was the journey south? What was, you know, when did it all start to become? Because I think you're obviously saying you're getting a sense that this is probably a bit more serious than we thought, given about the number of ships that were Ascension. Obviously, the nature of the exercises is changing. When did it all start to get real, do you think, and the crew think, crikey, this is a bit more serious than we anticipated?
We were heading south towards the Falklands, but I'm pretty sure we still didn't believe it would ever happen. Mm. And then it was announced that there was an exclusion zone. And people were saying, oh, blimey, this is for real then. And we did have a brief from Sandy Woodward, the commander-in-chief of that task force. He came on to Coventry and, I can't even remember how he got there, but he came on board and we had to go into the wardroom for a briefing, and he briefed us all to say how serious it was and to look around amongst us because we might not all go home together. And I think for me, that's when the penny dropped. Oh, blimey, we're in the middle of a proper conflict.
Yeah.
Or war, if you like.
Yeah.
A lot of people refer to it as a conflict, but most of the people that were down there would say they were at war.
I don't think there's any doubt about that from all the people I've spoken to. So it's been, you're right, you're absolutely right in saying that, but war it was, wasn't it? So was that, do you think the rest of the crew were thinking the same when Sandy Woodward said that?
Yeah, more or less, because we all looked at each other with sort of glazed expressions.
Yeah.
How true his words were, because I was stood with the guy next to me that I worked with on the flight, but on the other side of me was one of the guys that we left down there on patrol in the engine room.
Mm-hmm.
And a great big gentle giant of a man. And no longer with us and hasn't been for 40 years.
Yeah.
But that's another part of the story, isn't it, really? We carried on with our tasks and off we went. We had a helicopter that wasn't fully equipped to do the tasks they wanted us to do. So we had to go on board RFA Fort Austin and learn how to load sea skewers onto our helicopter, and we had to learn how to test the system and like. So then we went back to our ship, and our helicopter went back to the Fort Austin and came back with a different one that was modified and equipped to fire sea skewer missiles. And we then took the system and tested it rigidly. And then I think on the 3rd of May, they were tasked that there was some fast patrol boats gun running or running ammunition into the islands, and they had to engage. And they engaged with the sea skewer, and it worked perfectly. And
am I right in thinking this was a new weapon system? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that. We'd never seen it before.
Right.
When we were back at base in Yeovilton, we practiced with all the other equipment that we could fit onto the helicopter, the torpedoes, the depth charges, smoke and flame floats and stuff like that. But we'd never, ever seen a sea skewer missile until we were more or less in the exclusion zone.
Mm.
And I have to say that our helicopter was the first one to fire a sea skewer missile in anger, and it worked perfectly. And I always remember the boss, because we had to do regular servicing on that system. And when it came due for servicing, I mentioned to him that about when you finish flying today, I might need to test that system. He says, you can leave it alone. He says, I know it works. Please don't touch it. So, that was a jolly side of that. I used to always rib the boss because he was a Doncaster United supporter and he was always checking on the football results. But, yeah, we had a happy crew, I'll say that, and not just on the flight. On the flight, we gelled together remarkably. But the rest of the ship's crew, I have admiration for them, because I would happily go to sea with them ever again.
Wow.
A cracking bunch of guys, led by a cracking man as well.
Yeah. So you got to the exclusion zone. What happened next?
Well, we just literally all obeyed orders. Whatever the task commander dished out, we did. And we sailed around offering protection for this, that and the other. One of the exercises we were given was NGS, which is Naval Gunfire Support. So our 4.5 gun would then barrage places ashore, giving the troops a chance to land because the troops ashore were being barraged by our 4.5 shells. But in doing that, we got an army expert on board, and the helicopter used to have to take him and hover at a certain height so that he could examine through binoculars the effectiveness of the shelling.
Right.
And he could then radio to the gun crew, you know, changing elevation, changing direction or whatever to make it more effective. And I particularly know the two air crew weren't especially happy about that task because they were just hovering there like sitting ducks, waiting to be shot down. So they didn't like that particular task, but whenever it was tasked, they always performed it. So all power to their elbow, so to speak. They were good at doing that, yeah. But then quite often we were put on patrol in certain areas, and of course, in the ops room, with the 909 radars, we could detect aircraft at distance, and the ship could fire the Sea Dart missile and take out enemy aircraft, which it did on a few occasions. But also, we could control the CAP, which was the carrier air protection. So the Harriers flying around above us could be controlled by our ops room because of the position we were in.
Yeah.
So we were put on patrol in strategic positions where they wanted us to be.
So that's all about defending the fleet and the troops on the ground, isn't it?
Yeah. And mostly effective, apart from the gun on our ship, well, wasn't always that reliable. But many other Type 42 destroyers had guns that could replace us if ours jammed or whatever. And that happened on a few occasions. But on the fateful event, we were tasked with broadsword, line astern behind us, just going in a line to the north of Pebble Island. And we would go back and forth on this line and control the CAP. And the Harriers were directed in. And we actually sat on the back of HMS Coventry. We actually witnessed a dogfight above us between a Harrier and an Argentinian aircraft. Now, I know I'm ex-fleet air arm, but my aircraft recognition's not that good. It was a fixed-wing aeroplane. I'm not sure if it was a Mirage or one of the other ones, but the Harrier tied him in knots. His manoeuvrability was fantastic. And he engaged with his missiles and took the other one out of the air. It was fantastic to watch, but again, another life was taken.
Yeah.
And that's the sad part. Whenever we'd been successful in any of our defence or attacks, again, it was another life lost. And that was the mood on the ship when we fired the Sea Skua missiles was euphoric that night, but very, very subdued the next morning. And particularly the two aircrew, we couldn't speak to them. They'd just eliminated 15 people or so, whatever the number of that ship was. And but then we were doing a job just like the Argentinians. There was no ill will. It's just the fact that, you know, if we don't do it to you, you're going to do it to us.
Yeah.
And vice versa, I'm sure. And then we were tasked off Pebble Island. We did that task, and then the captain stood the CAP down and engaged with Sea Dart and took out some more aircraft. And then the intelligence told us there was a wave of aircraft had left Argentina and they were coming for us. apparently we were a thorn in their side. And it was the 25th of May, which was their Independence Day. So we knew there would be a concerted effort that day.
Yeah.
They came at us from the starboard side. We had two aircraft coming at us, and from the front, two aircraft coming at us. The two coming at us from the starboard side veered off. And I'm not sure if it was because they'd seen a strobe light that they'd not seen before, and so they veered off, and possibly they veered off towards the broadsword, because what was coming at them wasn't as severe.
Mm.
Anyway, they dropped the bomb, and one bomb bounced off the top of the sea and through the side of the ship, up through the deck, took the nose of the helicopter off, and then went harmlessly over the other side of the ship. So it caused damage, but not exploded.
So what was your role at this point? Because obviously, you know, I imagine you're not maintaining aircraft when it's all, you're all at battle stations. What's your role?
No, we were told, well, the story was our pilot asked me, I suppose I better explain, when we check the rotation of the blades, we put reflectors on and we point a strobe light at them to make sure that all the blades are going round in the same plane. And we can adjust them. Well, that strobe light, my pilot asked if I could adjust the frequency of it. And I said, yes, we can. And he said, well, if you put it to 50 hertz, that's what's happening in discos where people are throwing fits or whatever. Well, we corrected the pilot and pointed out to him that they were epileptic. And it's hardly unlikely that the Argentinian pilots would be epileptics. But anyway, he says, well, just point it at them at 50 hertz. And so we had two GPMGs, and we had one on a mounting on the helicopter and one on a mounting on the bollards, and they were all pointing at the aircraft coming at us from the starboard side.
Mm.
So the two GPMGs were firing away, and me with my strobe light, and we had another seven or eight self-loading rifles laid on the deck that we could use. And in times of attack like that, we could use just normal defense weapons, but they're only rifles against a fast moving target anyway. And like I said, the two coming at us from the starboard side veered off and damaged the broadsword and the helicopter, but the two coming from the front, we couldn't see. And the broadsword behind us would engage with Seawolf. That was the close-range missiles. But the Seawolf kept disengaging, and then the order was given to turn to starboard to open up the arcs for our Sea Dart, because the 909 radars that guide the Sea Dart were locking onto the landmass.
Right.
So having turned to starboard, we presented a bigger target to the two aircraft coming from the front and blocking off broadsword behind us. And that's when it happened. The bombs came in and we got the order to take cover. So we just ran into the hangar and tried to put as much of the ship between us and the oncoming aircraft. And that's what happened. And again, when they hit us with these bombs and they exploded, it was just like we'd hit a big wave or something. But after that, it became obvious because of the smoke billowing out of the side of the ship and the fact that the ship started to list almost immediately.
Mm.
And there was no communications with the bridge or whatever. So as she was listing, we tried to start the helicopter to get him off, but she was listing too badly. And there was a lot of spent cartridges floating around over the deck. Well, if they get sucked into the engine, it's a goner anyway.
Mm.
So we shut him down and we all got dressed into our once-only suits and left the ship going to a life raft.
So how would you describe that moment? You know, what was going through your head, or you just like knew what you needed to do? Is it, because it's difficult, just trying to get so our listeners can get an appreciation of what you're thinking and feeling at that moment.
I was bemused. out of all of our training and normal exercise functions, none of this had ever been practiced before.
Yeah.
So it was all new to us, and we didn't really know what was going on. And normally, you would wait for an order to abandon ship, but it became obvious that that order wasn't coming. And I think it was our flight commander says, we've got no communications with the bridge or the ops room. He says, I think we should start to leave because the ship, having been bombed and exploded, opened up the side of the ship. And with the swell and the wind and the tides and this, that, and the other, she started to list heavily to the port side. So we got dressed into once-only suits, ready to leave the ship. But as I was about to leave, I remembered that we'd been told, some time earlier, to pack a bag of warm clothes and things. So I went to get my bag of warm clothes. And as I came out of there, I noticed my camera hanging over the winch handle. So I put the camera in the bag. But by then, the ship was listing quite heavily. So I had to climb up the deck and over the guardrails and just slide down the side of the ship into the water and swim to a life raft. And once in the life raft, I passed my camera to the guy in the doorway and asked him to take some shots of the ship sinking, basically. But she was going over, and we got four or five shots of that. And somebody on the broadsword photographed all the aircraft attacking us, and I've got some of those shots. I can't remember for the life of me where I got them, but they're keepsakes about what we were going through. And again, it was all just, I would have said it was nothing more than what you would fantasize about without really having experienced it. And yet, it stuck in my memory as if it was yesterday.
Of course. How long did this take, Mick? I'm just trying to get a sense of, was it a matter of minutes and it seems longer to you? What is that, what it was like, or was it taking a long time for her to list?
I've heard lots of people say that when they've had a severe accident, their life's passed before them. And it's similar to that in the fact that you seem to have plenty of time. And yet, when we reflect on it, that ship was almost turned turtle in 15 minutes.
Crikey.
So there wasn't really a lot of time, but most of the blokes, when given an order, they were good at carrying it out and getting it done. So when our flight commander says, look, we've got to think about abandoning ship, they all went straight into the action. They carried the gear with them wherever they went, because we were at action stations. So out came the once-only suits, and you could see them instantly getting dressed, scrambling up the deck over the guardrails and gone. And when I got to the life raft, I was one of the last ones to leave that flight deck.
Mm.
But when I got to the life raft, it was well full. Lots of people had the same idea, get ready and go. And it doesn't take long to get ready to go. It was the instance of making your mind you were going to go. Once that happened, and that would be a good 5 minutes or maybe 10 minutes after the bomb struck, then everybody burst into action. And some of the guys down from the bowels of the ship got people out that would have gone down with the ship. There's no way they could have made it on their own.
Mm.
And so some of the guys were quite heroic in getting the other people out. And I don't know who launched the life raft, but somebody did. And they were all there, but they were all from the starboard side, not from the port side.
Yep.
So there wasn't enough life rafts for everybody to be safe in a life raft. And there were many people hanging off the sides. And they were the first ones airlifted because of hypothermia, and that water was blooming cold.
Mm.
It was a bit of a shock when I went in there. I thought, crikey. But, well, as you can well imagine, the words weren't crikey.
No. And I can understand that. So you're literally off the ship into the sea, and then your comrades get you into a life raft. Is that how it happened?
Yeah. I had my rucksack or my holdall as a flotation aid. So I was just kicking my legs and floating away to the life raft. And then the guys there, two great big guys on the door, just grab you and hoik you in.
Yeah.
There was a commander, a lieutenant commander in there, and he says, I don't care how big and bold we are, we all get seasick at times, so we all had to take an anti-seasick tablet. And I think the most of us didn't feel seasick until we took the bloody tablet, but we did. And then these helicopters turned up, and they were just lifting people out of the life raft. And myself, the senior maintenance rating, another lad off the flight, and the other guy who did flight deck officer, we ended up as the last four because we knew, being part of the flight, what the winching drills were. And so many of them, as the helicopter came in, and it's got a hook dangling down, but if you touch that hook, you're going to earth the helicopter and you will feel the discharge of all that static.
Yeah.
We had to keep slapping them away until the hook went into the water. Then we could use it. And the strops, and we hoisted people off, and we ended up, we collapsed the roof of the life raft, and we were the last four sitting there. We got rid of the young lad, and then I was next to go, and the other two senior guys were following me. But as they picked me up, the winds jammed. I'd been ordered by a guy to throw my hold all away, but he got politely told where to go. And after three occasions, he accepted the fact that the bag was going with me. What he didn't know was that I had a checkbook, cigarettes and clothing in there, as well as my camera. So they winched me up and the winch jammed. So they pulled me in and they wrote on a chalkboard to let the guys in the life raft know that the winch had jammed, but another helicopter was coming in to get them. And then we set off, but I could see the broadsword and lots of helicopters and boats taking survivors in there. So I worried for a short while that they were going to do a head count and I would be listed as missing in action. So I tapped the guy on the helmet and said, where are we going? And he said, we're going back to my ship, the Fort Austin. And I said, okay. And so we went to the Fort Austin. And then once we were on the Fort Austin, he guided me down into their dining hall. And when we got into the dining hall, I could see plenty of other people from the Coventry. So I was quite relieved that when they did the final head count, I wasn't going to be missed. And my folks back home weren't going to be told that I was missing in action. As it happened, they got told that I'd survived, but they didn't know if I'd got any injuries. And then they got told I had no injuries, but they weren't sure if I was coming home or being deployed onto another ship or whatever. But eventually, we all came home on the QE2.
Mick, so when you got onto the Fort Austin and you went down the decks and you saw your comrades from Coventry, what was the mood like? Was anybody saying anything, or was everybody shocked? What was that moment like?
It was pretty shocked, where people were just milling around, all with a dazed expression, thinking, well, what's just happened? But whenever you saw somebody you knew, there was a great big hug because you were so pleased.
Yeah.
They were pleased that you were alive and you were pleased that they were alive.
Yeah.
But again, we didn't have all the flight members. And that worried me because I knew when we got bombed and we were shooting at the enemy aircraft, I knew none of us were injured. So it worried me that we weren't all there. And then the broadsword, under cover of darkness, came to the Fort Austin and offloaded all the survivors she had.
Yeah.
Then we all got together and the flight was complete. And a big sigh of relief that the flight was complete, because We worked long hours together. We didn't live together because of the different ranks, but we spent a lot of time together and became real good buddies. Mm-hmm. And so it was pleasing to find that they all survived. On reflection, after what Sandy Woodward said, take a look around you, we might not all come home together. And I still got the image in my head now. That morning, 25th of May, I got up out of my bunk, and there's three bunks. I'm in the middle one, and three bunks opposite, and the guy in the middle one, Paddy White, was there, and he always got up round about the same time as me, because we weren't shift workers, if you like. And he always said, "Good morning, Mick," and I always said, "Good morning, Paddy." Then he'd go off to the ablutions and myself, whatever, and we get dressed and go to work. He would be in the computer room next to the ops room, and I would be on the flight deck. Never saw him again. Mm. He was in the room where the bomb exploded.
Yeah.
And a few others that I was closer to that sort of never came back. And, few years ago, when I was instructing, one of the guys came up to me and said, "Were you on HMS Coventry?" And I said, "Yeah, I was." He says, "Did you know Foxy Fowler?" I said, "Yes, I did. I spoke to him every day." And he says, my partner would love to talk to you." And I said, "Oh, why is that then?" He says, "That was her dad." And, God, did I get a lump in my throat? Yeah. And she wanted to meet me and talk to me. And I was dubious because I didn't know really what she wanted to know. If she wanted to know how her dad died, there's no way I was going to tell her that.
Yeah.
And what state he was in and this, that, and the other, because I didn't know. But if she wanted to know what I thought of her dad, then I would happily tell her what a smashing guy he was, you know. And that was exactly what she wanted to know, because she was only a very young girl when he died.
Mm.
And she wanted to know more about her dad as a person. And I was happy to meet up and tell her. But that's more or less the story. We were on Fort Austin for a couple of nights, and under cover of darkness, because she was in the middle of Falkland Sound, what they called Bomb Alley. Mm. So they brought us out of there and took us to a cargo ship from Ness, and she all the holds that she had were modified to have bunks welded in, and we had the comfort of sleeping in bunks, and that was about the only comfort on that ship. And then we went from there down towards South Georgia, where we met up with the QE2, who'd literally come back from a world cruise and then been commandeered by the government. And she brought lots and lots of troops down, particularly Gurkhas. And then we all got on there and we were treated like lords. It was fantastic. The only thing I would say that was bad about that, they gave me a single cabin on my own. Too much time to reflect. But we had a fabulous time on there. And it was a little bit annoying. It took us 25 days to get down there to the south. Took us over a month to get there, over a month for them to find and sink us. And the QE2 took 11 days to get us home. We could have done with another tour of Britain, probably. But that's been selfish, isn't it, really? Because all your family wanted to see you home and safe.
Yeah, of course.
And that's exactly what happened. We landed in Southampton, and they had a great big, shed, and all the families were in there waiting to greet us as we came off the gangway on Queen Elizabeth. I don't know what else to say now.
That must have been an emotional moment.
Oh, very. Yeah. I don't often shed tears, but I did that day.
Mm.
Yeah. My mum and dad came down from Leeds with my brother. My brother didn't really get any choice. Mum and dad says, "You're taking us to to Weymouth." "Oh, right, okay." And they met me in the shed. And my mum was carrying my little one, I had three daughters, and she passed the little one over the barriers to me. I still had my hold all, and I was carrying the baby. And I say baby, she was a few years old. And then the barriers opened, and of course I got a hug off my mum and my dad. My dad, bless him, he's always the opportunist. There was a bank of telephones in the corner of the shed, and it was free to phone anybody. So he was phoning his brother in Belfast, and he put me on the blooming phone. And the brother in Belfast, my uncle, he said that I owed him a bottle of whiskey, because from the minute we got sunk to the minute he found out I was okay, he'd gone through a bottle of whiskey, so I owed him one. He got one some years later. And my wife was there with my other two children and her friend, or our friend that lived where we lived in Weymouth. She'd driven them up as well, and we all went back as a little package. But we had to stop in the New Forest on the way home. I just needed a pint and calm down. Because it was, as you say, very, very emotional. But the kids, they were laughing and joking and happy that Dad the dipstick was home, really.
Dad the dipstick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially since then, we took the opportunity to have fun at any opportunity and any chance we got. And whenever I wasn't at work, the girls were with me down the fleet or wherever. Wherever I went, they followed. Brilliant.
So 40 years on, how do you reflect on the war?
With sadness, really. I've watched a couple of documentaries recently, and Mr. Knott didn't come out of that very well, I didn't think. And there was somebody else as well. But we have these politicians and diplomats that are supposed to sort these things. And listening to that documentary, they didn't think the Argentinians had the guts to do it. And so they discarded it. And look what happened. 258 people have died.
Yeah.
There's a memorial for them up on the hill here at Portsmouth. And there's a copse of trees, and there's 258 trees in that copse. 255 for the servicemen that died, and 3 for the civilian women that died as well. And I go up there quite often. There's a burger wagon up there as well. So I quite often go sit up there on a nice day like today, just sit there and contemplate what went on and how it happened and how really it should never have happened. I'm a proud owner of the medal, and I wear it with pride. But wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to?
It would. It would.
Yeah.
Do you think did it change your outlook on life?
Oh, exactly, yeah. From that day onwards, I thought to myself, if I wake up tomorrow morning and I've got another day ahead of me, then it's a bonus because it could so easily have been taken away. I wasn't an introvert before, but I'm definitely more of an extrovert now, because I want to just enjoy life and every minute of it. And, my kids still look on it. And, I mean, my youngest one's 40-odd now, but they still love time with Dad and the grandkids, because as far as they're concerned, life's a breeze. Let's enjoy it. Whatever we've got it, we need to enjoy it. And that is my outlook on life now. And never is an opportunity missed. Like talking to you. When Chris Howe told me, put my name forward, yeah, let's do it.
Brilliant. Do you know, mate, thank you so much for sharing that story, but I'm really impressed by the way you talk about how it changed you. I mean, obviously the sadness is still there because you've lost friends, but also how that's changed your life in a positive way and living life to the max with each day. I think that's a great message to finish on, I think.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much.
No, thank you. And thank you for sharing that story. I think it's very, very important people hear this, and obviously with the commemorations later on this year.
Yeah, many of them I've put my name forward for.
I may bump into you then, which would be good.
Yes, that'd be nice to meet up and have a drink. Yeah,
indeed it would. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Now, before Stephen might look back at the interview we've just heard, you may be interested to know that here at Company of Makers, we've got loads of online activities for veterans to get involved in. As well as this podcast, we've got online talks with inspiring guests, and we've got workshops where you can learn something new and meet like-minded people from the forces. To find out more, sign up for our newsletter and we'll send all the latest updates direct to your inbox. Just head over to companyofmakers.com/newsletter. Now back to Steve and Mike.
What a fascinating chap. I think it's called Coventry Flight, isn't it? Isn't that the technical term? I might have learned something, you see.
Yeah, a team of 15 on board that fly, maintain and work up the helicopter on board. I thought of a title for this episode. Well, which he provided towards the end. It said, "Dad, the dipstick comes home," which is what his son told him when he met him at Weymouth, coming off the QE2. "Dad, the dipstick comes home," I thought was the title.
It's a good title.
I'm not sure if he'd be very pleased with it, but actually it was a really good perspective. Very, very different from Chris Howe's perspective, which obviously... deep in the bowels of the ship in the ops room, took about most of the effects of the bomb that hit them, and still lived, but in incredible pain and sheer grit and determination to get off the ship and keep, and recover. Whereas Mick's tale, was taken from, he wasn't an observer because he was involved. He talks about being told to use this strobe instrument that was used to make sure the rotors were all turning in sync. This strobe instrument tuned to 50 hertz to see if they could get some epileptic RG pilots to pass out. But, I mean, it's like the canteen manager in Fearless, firing at them. Everybody was involved.
It sounds like the sonic screwdriver from Doctor Who. Maybe that's where they got the idea from. But seriously, I think given that, Chris and Mick were on the same ship, which obviously was sunk very soon after it was hit, they were what? I don't know how big these ships were, but they were may have been 20 or 30 metres apart on the same ship at the same moment, and yet completely different experiences and stories of exactly the same events. And I think that's been one of the great insights throughout this series of chats we've had.
No, I completely agree. And Chris, of course, doesn't remember big chunks of it because of the pain he was in, what he was going through, whereas Mick sort of talks about how time sort of slowed down. He reckoned it was about 15 minutes between being hit and abandoning ship, getting into a life raft. And actually, but he said that seemed to go very slowly and almost calmly. They knew what to do, even though they'd never done it before. There was no panic. And even though no order was given to abandon ship, they knew they had to do it. It became pretty obvious when the ship was at 45 degrees listing to port. There was a couple of nuggets there as well that I hadn't really fully realised, that because she was listing to port, the only life rafts they could relieve were those on the starboard side, which meant they could only release about 50% of them. So actually quite a large number of the crew didn't have a life raft to get into, and had to cling to the sides of it until a helicopter came and plucked them out. And this is April in the South Atlantic. It's not warm.
Not the best time to go skinny dipping, is it?
No. He talked about these once-only suits they managed to put on, and these are thick plastic rubber onesies, I suppose, that cover you, give you a layer of protection against the cold. They're not necessarily waterproof, but what they do is, if they trap water, is the water heats up against your body and provides some form of insulin, insulation. So you asked him what his mood was when all this was going on, and he used a very, and he didn't use a word I thought would come up, which was bemused. He said he was bemused by it all. Mm. I think he was probably in shock, actually. And I think, you know, he didn't quite know what to think, what to make of it all. You know, he obviously wasn't inside the ship when it happened. He was pointing his strobe at the planes, trying to put them off or cause epileptic fits. But and he watched. He said he watched one of the bombs bounce on the water, cause a little bit of damage, but didn't explode, and then fall into the water. You know, and he describes the actual bomb that did hit them as just being like a great wave hitting them, a thud, which is the word that Chris Hout used in his chat. And then, of course, then they saw the smoke and the ship started to list as water came in, and he realised that it must have gone off. But, you know, he wasn't describing a big explosion.
No, and I think also there's this idea that, you know, they'd had a successful deployment up until that part. They played a key part throughout the entire conflict. And I guess that kind of, maybe that relates to the bemusement, the experience and thought, this you can't be happening to us perhaps, because, you know, we're a tight team, we're an effective team. Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. And of course, HMS Coventry is best known for, you know, protecting the task force until the 25th of May, when she was sunk. And actually what Mixtail did is not very well known. He's talk about this, they changed the helicopter during their transit south to one fitted with a new weapon system called Sea Skewer, and they were the first ones to fire it in anger, and to their astonishment it worked. He said we fired it, the first to fire it, and it worked. And I thought that was wonderful. So actually, you know, Coventry Flight, you rock. You had the first Sea Skewer engagement. And I hope that Coventry is known for lots of things, and that's one of them.
Mm, I'd agree. But after that, when he got back, his approach to life was quite interesting, I thought.
Yeah. Again, he didn't suffer injury, or not physical injury, that is. He describes his journey back on the QE2 as being treated like lords. He's actually slightly unhappy to have a single cabin, because although that's nice to have the privacy of a single cabin, of course he didn't have. It meant he spent some time on his own reflecting over things, I think. And then, as you know, in the emotional reunion with his family at Weymouth. And his son calling him Dad the Dipstick.
Dad the Dipstick comes home.
Yeah. And his father, you know, using all the free telephones to telephone his brother, or his uncle, his father's brother. And his uncle said, the first thing he says to him is, you owe me a bottle of whiskey. Because that's what I drank until I realised you were okay. It's a funny way of saying welcome
home.
Yeah,
so glad you're all right. Where's my whiskey?
Yeah, indeed. There's a couple of things that came up that I think have or will reoccur during these discussions. That is the one of the mood or attitude. Immediately something happens that is successful but means the loss of life on one side or the other. Mm. So when they did the Sea Skewer engagement, the first one, they took out 15 lives, I think he said. The mood on board, being that first engagement, was euphoric, he said. That was the word he used. But barely 24 hours later, everybody was very subdued, whilst they then reflected on, yes, but 15 people lost their lives. Mm. And that, I think that comes across. I know we're not interviewing anyone on the Conqueror about the Belgrano, but I know from lots of submarine mates I've got, that was exactly the same situation. You know, they euphoric that the attack worked, they were subdued very shortly after, is about the implications of that and the number of people that lost their lives in the Belgrano. So that's a repeat.
Yeah.
You know, there's immediate euphoria and then on reflection, you know, a subduing of that emotion as they realise what it means.
I think that's got to be to do with the fact that you're all sailors and, you know, there, but for the grace of God, go I. It could happen to you, couldn't it, I guess? And when those possibilities start to sink in, and, you know, taking life is not a fun occupation at all. It's necessary in this situation. And I think it just, you realise what's actually happening and it becomes very, very real.
Yeah. Mick also talked about a couple of shipmates he knew really well. And, you know, he used to say, good morning, Paddy, to every day, you know, every day, who are no longer with us. And also meeting the daughter of someone that's no longer with us and what that meant to him. You've obviously picked up that no one ever uses their proper names in the Navy. So Paddy is almost certainly not Paddy. He's probably not even Patrick, but he's probably Irish. And Foxy Fowler certainly doesn't look like a fox. I don't know what he did look like. But everyone gets these names. So you're going to have to compile a dictionary of naval names at some stage.
So what was yours?
Oh, I was Danger Mouse.
Danger Mouse?
Well, it was just a play on my surname, DM.
Ah, okay. It's not to do anything the way you look, I can assure you of that.
There's nothing mouse-like about me, I can tell you. I do like cheese, though, I have to say.
Ah.
No, nothing wrong with a nice bit of cheddar. Wensleydale? Yes, sir? Anyway, that's straight from Monty Python. Last thing, and again, as you know, I used to live in Portsmouth until 8 months ago, and I didn't know this, but there's a memorial to the Falkland vets, the 258 people that lost their lives, 255 service men, and the three ladies, the islanders, that lost their lives. And there's 258 trees planted in a copse on the top of Portsdown Hill, which I've never been to. I wish I'd known that before I'd moved. In fact, if and when I come back to Portsmouth to visit Muckers, may even visit you, ooh, if you're lucky.
Oh, is that a compliment?
No. I would like to go and see that. I think that would be quite interesting. He also mentioned there was a burger van very nearby, which could, you know, if you can't cook, that could do.
Well, I didn't know about the cops either. So if you do come down, we'll go and have a look together and maybe fit in a burger as well. I can hear what you're saying.
Anyway, I think on, you know, Mick gave a really different perspective, really interesting, different perspective. I don't think he's told that story before. So another of your triumphs in an untold story by a veteran now out there. Well done.
Thank you very much. But it is a team effort, as well you know. There's lots of us working on this. But yes, it is fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. The more people I talk to, the more I learn, it has to be said.
Yeah, shall we end on Mick DeLucci's parting comment was, never an opportunity missed. You know, make the most of what time you have got, because you never know what might happen in the future. That's his motto now.
And a very good motto it is. Thank you very much, Mike.
You're welcome. Hi, it's Mike here again. So just to let you know, this podcast accompanies the stunning Falklands 40th commemorative book produced by TheVeteran.uk on behalf of the South Atlantic Medal Association, SAMA 82. And we'd like to say a really big thank you to both our funders for making this possible, namely TheVeteran.uk and SAMA. And if you'd like to buy a copy of the book, then please head to either the veteran.uk website or sama82.org.uk. Thanks for listening.
Before we finish, we'd love to hear from you. So if you've got any thoughts, suggestions, or even a bit of banter, just email us at podcast@companyofmakers.com. You never know, you might even get a mention. And don't forget to hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you. This podcast was produced by Rachel Owen, hosted by Mike Davis Marks, and me, recorded and edited by yours truly.
Company of Makers, podcast talks, workshops.